circulating for demonstrations this week to demand the barring of new arrivals from the mainland. And Mrs. Lam said that although the city would continue to contain suspected cases, it would be inappropriate and impractical to block people from the mainland. The government condemned the fire set at the public housing complex in Hong Kong's new territory, but also backed away from its plans to use the building for quarantine, saying that it would use government-owned sites first. Fears about the spread of the virus are also affecting tourism in the city. Now, that's not surprising. Whose economy depends significantly on money spent by visitors at malls, hotels, and restaurants, which is now in a recession. Two of Hong Kong's biggest attractions, Disneyland and Ocean Park, said on Sunday that they were closing until further notice. A notice on Hong Kong's Disneyland website called it a precautionary measure. Shanghai's Disneyland Park had earlier been shut indefinitely. China said Saturday that it would suspend all tour groups and the sale of flight and hotel packages for its citizens headed overseas starting on Monday. The week-long Lunar New Year holiday, which began on Saturday, is usually a peak travel period in China. Roads were quiet where cars, trucks, and motorbikes once roared and honked. There was the sound of birds tweeting and dogs barking. Shoppers mostly hauled their baskets home by foot or on bicycles. Let me drop for a sec. Wuhan, the city at the center of China's viral epidemic crisis, has been subdued since the government put it under a smothering net of travel restrictions on Thursday. It was even quieter on Sunday after the city announced heavy restrictions on the use of cars, even within the urban limits. The announcements about which vehicles were allowed on the road was murky, leaving even police officials befuddled about what to do. First, the Wuhan authorities said that most cars should stay off the road and that a fleet of 6,000 taxis would be on call to transport people in need and deliver food and medicine. Then, the authorities said drivers would be notified by text message if they had to stay off the road. Nobody seemed to receive any text messages on Sunday. Quote, my understanding, a police official said, is that you can drive in your district if you don't get a text message telling you that you can't, but that you should check with the transport authority. In the end, most drivers stayed off the streets, but as the day went on, more ventured out, and police did not seem to do much about it. For some residents, it was another exasperating fumble by Wuhan's officials, who many believe have mishandled the epidemic, but most seem to accept the restrictions with the same stoic fortitude that many have shown over the past several days as the city imposed bans on leaving for all but a select few. Let me drop for a sec. On Sunday morning, many grocery shops in Wuhan were crowded with residents queuing to stock up, especially on fresh vegetables, fruits, and meat. Many said that they were worried about even tighter rules that could deter them from leaving home or impede their food supplies. Because it's a new year, a lot of stores close anyway, and now we have the disease, and now this, said Ai Wenjun, who had lined up to pay for a basket of turnips, cabbage, and beans. Each extra thing makes me worry more. So far, shops still have supplies, though some residents said prices had risen despite government warnings to keep them steady. Quote, if we can't bring in produce, it will become more expensive, or we might even have to close up, said Zhou Jingko, who was selling piles of cucumbers, turnips, and tomatoes. As he spoke, a woman accused him of unfairly raising the prices of his turnips. Every county, every village around here is now putting up barriers, worried about the disease, Mr. Zhu said. Even if the government says it wants food guaranteed, it won't be easy. All those road checks. For now, the Wuhan city authorities have the benefit of a population willing to endure restrictions to slow the epidemic. But that mood shift can change if measures to hamper food supplies worsen and medical shortages occur. Now is not the time for recrimination, said Li Zengdu, a retired business manager. The local government wasn't forthcoming with information and didn't make vigorous enough measures, but we need to get through this first and then we can assign blame later. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments about this mess. This is AC2GS.
My first question, Roy, is how did the name coronavirus come about? And second of all, I'm going to be away from the mic for a little while. So when you finish, please pass it straight over to Paul. AC2GS, K2RIW.
K-Tech, no problem. I think it gets its name just from the visual appearance of the viral particles. There's been more than a few in the newspaper that it has a kind of spherical shape to it, and that's where it got its nomenclature. They're not using SARS for this particular infection. There are some articles that mention them as being SARS-like, but it's closely related to what we know of SARS in 2002-2003 over the last 16, 17 years. Apparently the virus or the progenitor of the virus mutated. Usually it's an animal-based virus. It doesn't become infectious to human beings until it mutates, and then in environments where people and wild animals get together a lot, that's where it jumps from one to the other.
So it is respiratory, therefore SARS fits, but they had to give it a different name because it is a different virus.
It's very closely related. We really don't have all the details yet because there's not enough epidemiological data to base things on. They seem to think that it is as infectious as SARS was. They don't know how the mortality rate is. Much like influenza itself, you usually see a lot of deaths in the elderly and infirmed, at first at least. And then as the dust settles, you can get a better sense for the mortality rate. That's what worries a lot of people. Although influenza is probably a much more infectious process, there's a lot more percentage-wise reports of complications and deaths with SARS-like virus than with influenza.
This thing seems to be so spread so far already. To quarantine and control it sounds like it's going to be very difficult. Is it better or worse than Ebola, if you know what I mean, as far as infectability, if that's a word? Over to you, Roy.
Well, in some ways, I guess you could say it's better than Ebola. It's more infectious, but it's less deadly. But, you know, with Ebola makes such an enormous impression on people that almost immediately everything clicks into isolating the virus, whereas this one is a sneaky little devil. There are reported cases, apparently, where it can incubate without much of a clinical sign for as long as 2 weeks. Now, you'll see pictures of airline people at airports flashing these infrared detectors on people's foreheads to see if they have a fever, which is all well and good if they have a fever. But I worry about just if you take enough Tylenols or aspirins, you could knock a fever down a bit. And there are a lot of people who probably are within the two-week period where the infection has not bloomed fully, where you will not be able to detect them with any ease. So we're making the best of a terrible situation. It would be good if we had a time machine, could go back to about 6 weeks or 7 weeks ago and shut down Wuhan. The genie is out of the bottle, unfortunately. There are cases that are being reported in Asia, in Europe, and in the United States. That's not good. Any other questions or comments on this catastrophe, or otherwise I'll move on to the next story, which isn't as bad as this one. This is the worst one for tonight. Okay, very well. The White House initially minimized the consequences of retaliatory Iranian missile strikes that hit joint U.S.-Iraqi bases in Iraq on January 8th in response to the president's decision to assassinate a senior Iranian official. But last week, news broke that at least 11 U.S. troops had actually been treated for traumatic brain injury. Pentagon spokesperson Jonathan Hoffman told reporters at a press conference on Friday that the number is now up to 34. Trump and Secretary of Defense Mike Esper had tried to downplay the injuries earlier this week, with Trump claiming those treated just had a headache and weren't really that serious, and Esper saying it was mostly outpatient stuff. Now the number of soldiers diagnosed with traumatic brain injury has more than tripled from earlier estimates, and at least 17 of these troops are still being observed at locations in the United States and Germany. According to ABC News, per NPR, Hoffman said that 8 of these 17 troops had arrived back in the U.S. and would be treated on an outpatient basis, while the 9 in Germany remain in Landstuhl Regional Medical Center. It's clear that the present administration has gone above and beyond in its efforts to portray the Iranian counterattack as a blip on the radar, but the delay in notifying the public about injuries is likely in due partly to the difficulty of diagnosing traumatic brain injury. Medical experts told reporters that while the continued holding of soldiers for over 2 weeks would indicate their injuries aren't minor, there are numerous reasons it can take a long time to identify brain trauma and determine the extent of any damage. Let me drop for a second. Blast traumatic brain injuries are a specific type of traumatic brain injury that's caused by physical forces exerted on the brain by the energy generated in an explosion. That wave of energy can cross the skull and cause significant damage to the brain independently of any sort of impact. We know from clinical studies that blast injuries are serious. They can have long-lasting effects and can lead to significant neurological disabilities. We also know from imaging that blast can lead to extensive disseminated damage that differs significantly from patient to patient. It can take time to identify traumatic brain injury from explosions, as the symptoms can be nonspecific and overlap significantly with other issues like post-traumatic stress disorder after the initial phase immediately following the blast, in which individuals may lose consciousness or feel dazed and confused. People with traumatic brain injury may feel as though they have returned to normal, but in the following days to weeks, they could experience delayed symptoms like headaches, trouble concentrating or speaking, impulse control issues, emotional lability, and anxiety. Service members may also be reluctant to report and or minimize their symptoms for worry that it could be perceived as a weakness by others or to avoid leaving their units. Hoffman told journalists at the press conference that Esper had ordered a review of how the military tracks and reports injuries to service members, according to ABC. Quote, sometimes the administrative reporting of an injury is different than the medical reporting, Hoffman told reporters. We need to get that clarified. We need to get better handle on that. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, unfortunately, due to the linking problem between Glen Oaks and Selden, I can't make out a single word. I'm terribly sorry. Any other questions or comments about this particular story, or I'll move on to the next one. Okay. DirecTV is rushing to move one of its satellites to a higher orbit due to the likelihood it will go boom, Space News reported this past Wednesday. Backup high-power Model 702 satellite Spaceway 1 weighs about 13,400 pounds and was previously used to directly broadcast high-definition TV from its orbital slot at 102.8 degrees west longitude. Space News wrote, and more recently was demoted to providing backup K-band capacity in the Alaska region. DirecTV told the Federal Communications Commission in December filing that due to an unexplained incident, Spaceways One's batteries suffered, quote, significant and irreversible thermal damage and now pose a potential catastrophe, a catastrophic risk of going blammo in February, when the craft will pass into the Earth's shadow and automatically switch from solar power to its battery backup. While Spaceway One's broadcasting capabilities have been switched off, there's no way of preventing it from trying to draw power from the damaged cells, according to the company. DirecTV told the FCC it was, quote, urgent that Spaceway 1 be fully deorbited and decommissioned prior to the February 25th start of the eclipse season. If Spaceway 1 goes kabloom at this current position in its geostationary arc, the resulting debris could splatter into other satellites, which themselves could go kersunk. Let me drop for a set. For that reason, DirecTV wants to raise Spaceway 1 around 186 miles into what it calls the graveyard orbit, where procedures can be undertaken to help prevent retired satellites from interfering with those still in operation. Low Earth orbit satellites are usually disposed of by descent into the atmosphere or deorbiting. As Ars Technica noted, it's unclear why DirecTV used that term if it's actually raising the craft. Satellite operators are usually required to vent any remaining fuel on the craft before decommissioning it to reduce the risk of future kablooies. But DirecTV wrote in an FCC filing that while similar spacecraft undergo the procedure, normally take 2 to 3 months of continuous operation to fully deplete their propellant system. It only has around a month to do that job. This means you will only be able to vent a nominal amount of the 160 pounds of remaining fuel, which was originally intended to last it until 2025, according to the filing. No customer should see any service disruption due to Spaceway 1 already being downgraded to backup mode before its K-band capacity was turned off entirely. If it still does go thwomp in the graveyard orbit, it will do so with reduced potential harm to any other geostationary satellite operators, DirecTV wrote. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2 Jet. Okay, that was a new tone. Anyway, next story. We've been talking about the problems associated with home genetic testing, as has a lot of the global media, apparently, and it seems to have had an effect. The company behind a popular at-home DNA testing kit, 23andMe, has laid off roughly 100 employees amid waning demand for its product. The company confirmed to reporters that the layoff amounts to roughly 14% of the company's employees, adding that its consumer business was impacted company-wide. 23andMe CEO Anne Wojcicki told CNBC, which first reported the layoff, that she was surprised by the shift in demand. CNBC cited Wojcicki as noting privacy concerns would be one of the possible factors for the decline in sales, with Wojcicki telling the site that privacy is top of her mind for the company and that it has recently brought on new security chiefs. While CNBC reported that Wojcicki doesn't have any proof that consumer privacy fears are the primary driver for the spiraling sales, it certainly is a good rationale. There are plenty of other reasons that home DNA testing kits are losing their novelty. For one, research has found that these tests are not 100% accurate or even a complete snapshot of an individual's health profile. In fact, the tests have been known to be flat-out botched results at times. But if misleading or altogether inaccurate information isn't enough of a reason for users to give the kits a pass, their privacy should be as well. For example, if sharing information related to your genetic profile with pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline makes your skin crawl, well, 23andMe is probably not the product for you. Still, restoring trust in the company's policies around privacy, or rather the reanimated zombie version seemingly used by virtually every tech company, including the data butterfingers over at Facebook, appears to be one of the company's most foremost focuses right now. How else can they get away with selling a product and asking people to fork over highly sensitive personal genetic information about themselves in the year 2020? Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next one, which is a kind of echo from our past. I assume listeners by this point have probably sold their Boeing stock a long time ago, but just in case, here's another reason to consider getting into some safer investments, maybe like Bitcoin or something. Boeing is dealing with a yet another 737 MAX software flaw that could prevent the troubled aircraft from returning to the skies. But this time, it's not a safety issue. The company has confirmed that it's fixing a flaw preventing the 737 MAX's flight control computers from starting up and verifying that they're ready for flight. In other words, the airliner couldn't even take off. A spokesperson said Boeing was working with the FAA on submitting the fix and was informing partners, but didn't say when the updated software would be ready. This may have a ripple effect on Boeing's ability to complete testing. Wall Street Journal sources said Boeing and the FAA were supposed to run an important certification flight by the end of January, but the new bug makes it likely that this flight will be pushed to at least February. Boeing apparently discovered the problem last week when loading software onto a computer for a test aircraft. The findings add to a growing string of setbacks that led Boeing's freezing of the 737 MAX production until the aircraft is clear to resume flying. And even if the FAA approves software relatively soon, it could take a long time before existing aircraft are ready to resume business in the U.S., let alone in other countries. Still, officials don't want to take any chances. Boeing's design mistakes cost the lives of hundreds of people, and regulators will want to be very sure those flaws won't resurface again. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2 Jet.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I know Boeing is trying to save themselves. Now they have another brand new airplane that was just apparently released. I don't know if they flew it yet or not. The 777X. So it's another jet that. It was supposed to have, everything super duper modern, including wings on the very end. It looks like the last 10 feet or so, the wings would fold up, when pulled into a hangar. So very unique. So maybe that'll help pull them out of the hole. We'll see. Back to you.
I hope so, Paul. Boeing is kind of an important American company. People have repeatedly used the phrase that it's too big to fail. But if they keep on finding these problems, they might refute that in the end. I don't know. They've been cutting a bit of corners, which is usually gets you in trouble somewhere down the road. So I'm not the most optimistic person out there. And once again, it's not like I give any kind of investment advice, but if you were thinking of investing in Boeing, maybe you could find something a little less speculative, shall we say.
Yeah, okay. Too big to fail. Well, that's what they say with the auto industries when they all have problems, and they all got bailed out, so they didn't fail. Maybe they'll do that, too, if they get into big problems. But we'll see. But they've been around forever. I can't imagine a world without Boeing. But you never know. Back to you, Roy.
You never know with big business. They could kind of change their name, change their corporate identity, be bought by basically themselves and rebranded. There's all kinds of tricks businesses can play. I don't think that this is the end of Boeing by a long shot, but I just wonder how many times they can screw things up and get away with it. That's my only question right now.
Okay, yeah, they've had a tough couple of years between this, the two crashes. Now another problem with another jet, and then they had problems with the abort test that they had recently, not the abort test, the flight to the International Space Station was incomplete. They made it to orbit, but never made it to the space station with their Starliner. So that, at least they made it to orbit and back. I mean, they're happy about that, but it still was not 100%, maybe 90%.
Well, I hope they can dig themselves out of this hole that they made for themselves. You know, there's some very smart people working there. I don't know what went wrong. I'm sure there's going to be lots of books explaining in minute detail what went wrong. It's going to be published over the next 10, 15 years. But, you know, hope for the best. You know, Boeing is a very important part of American economics. And it would be sort of a shame if we lost it. I don't think we will. Again, might rebrand it, might change a name here or there, change, you know, people running it. But for all intents and purposes, I think it will survive this despite itself.
I concur. Okay. Back to you, Roy. We'll listen.
Okay, my next one is a much more whimsical article. You know, there's only so much bad news I can tell people. Are you interested in lighting a flame of space exploration in your grandchildren? Well, Lego might have you covered. Thanks to a new set from Lego, you'll soon be able to give the International Space Station the place of honor it deserves, either in your house, or your kid's house, or your grandkid's bedroom. The 864-piece model will set you back $70 when the company releases it on February 1st. Now, the set came out of a competition LEGO held last year for the 10th anniversary of its Ideas program. The initiative allows fans to submit concepts they'd like to see the company manufacture and sell. With 10,438 votes, the model won 45.6% of the community vote, beating out tough opponents like durable Stitch models. To create the final product, LEGO says it consulted with NASA, get all the details right, and thanks to the Ideas program, the two of them have been frequent collaborators in recent years. In 2017, LEGO released two NASA-inspired sets, a $170 replica of the Saturn V rocket, and a set of models honoring some of the space agency's early female pioneers. More recently, NASA helped LEGO with a lunar lander set honoring the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, I tried to get a good picture of what that was going to look like to see how detailed it was going to be. You know, it's probably a preliminary picture that I was looking at, but they're missing the front module, you know, called the Harmony, and they're missing a couple of pressure mating adapters, PSMA 1 and 2 and 3 they're missing. And I can't see the back. I can't see it. What I was looking at, it looks like they're missing quite a bit in the back. The Tranquility module and the cupola, was, you know, that's the thing with the big windows and the beam, the Bigelow external activity module that was bought up by Bigelow Corporation, you know, an inflatable thing. So I'm trying to see details, but I guess I'll have to wait until, what'd you say, February? I'm sure they'll have more accurate pictures of what it's going to look like. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I would hope that there'll be a lot more photographs of at the different angles. I'll post the article that I got it at. It's probably, though, the same image you're seeing. It's just one straight image head on. You can't see what's going on behind. So it'll be interesting to, you know, maybe next week or the following week when it comes out and there's other pictures, you can take a second look at it and report back on how many bits and pieces they left out.
Yeah, okay, that'd be good. I was trying to see how big it was physically. You know, it's going to be like a 2-foot model, 3-foot, you know. It's just hard to tell from that photograph.
Yeah, there's no great scale to it. I mean, there's something that looks like it could be a person, but it probably isn't. It's probably some other piece of gear that's at the base. So there's nothing, you know, and I'm not even quite sure. There is a space shuttle or something off to the side, but I don't know if that's in scale with the rest of it. You know, like I said, there'll be a lot of stuff, and I'm sure there'll be YouTubes. You know, people are Lego fans, and they'll open it up and put it together and show everyone in its glory.
Okay, yeah, well, Toys R Us is gone. They used to have a whole department, you know, you see all the stuff that they had. That's gone. I'll find it somewhere. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, brick and mortar is growing to be a thing in the past. You know, you'll find it on Amazon, you'll find it on a lot of websites. But it'll be interesting to see. You know, I thought people would be amused by it, and this is a story where no one's dying and no company's failing, so I figured I'd throw it in. Anyway, on to the next. Spoiling the fun of wondering whether you could be sharing your next flight with an emotional support peacock or perhaps even a miniature horse. The United States Department of Transportation is looking to crack down on the practice of bringing non-service trained animals onto commercial flights. The Department of Transportation announced this past Wednesday it is seeking public input on a proposed change to current rules that allow some travelers to fly with their emotional support pets, which in recent years have reportedly included everything from hamsters to reptiles and, yes, even tiny horses. The changes would amend the Air Carrier Access Act in several key ways, including by defining a service animal as a dog with specialized training to assist the needs of a person with a disability. In addition, under the proposed changes, emotional support animals would no longer be considered service animals. The rules would, among other changes, also allow carriers to limit the number of service animals able to travel with a single person to just two, as well as to allow them to require the animals to fit into the space between the owner's feet on the aircraft, which, if we're being honest, would only comfortably accommodate an emotional support ant on today's commercial aircraft. Let me drop for a sec. According to the Department of Transportation, passengers have attempted to fly with a peacock, ducks, turkeys, pigs, iguanas, and various other types of animals as emotional support or service animals, causing confusion for the airline employees and additional scrutiny for service animal users. The department said that while it recognized the integral role that service animals play in the lives of many individuals with disabilities, it's also hoping to put a stop to people who are misrepresenting their critters as service animals when in fact they're merely pets. The proposed changes also come amid crew reports of emotional support animals and particularly dogs attacking flight crew, other passengers, and even children. In a statement, Airlines for America President and CEO Nicholas Calio said in a statement that the organization is confident the proposed rules will go a long way to ensuring a safer and healthier experience for everyone. Quote, "Airlines want all passengers and crew to have a safe and comfortable flying experience, and we are confident the proposed rules will go a long way in ensuring a safer and healthier experience for everyone," Calio added. "The public now has 60 days to comment on the proposed changes. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. From the same administration that brought you the erroneous belief that Thomas Alva Edison invented the light bulb, and a new demonstration of completely misunderstanding history in that the wheel was invented right here in the good old U.S. of A., comes this next particular story. As we have discussed before on this very Science Talk, the president has been pushing to create a new military branch dubbed Space Force since 2018, and this past week tweeted out a logo for the department. The most noticeable part of the logo is right in the center, where a design that closely resembles Star Trek's arrowhead-style Starfleet insignia sits. However, the resemblance is less surprising once you see the logo of the Air Force's Space Command, which is a branch that is being rebranded as Space Force. It also features the arrowhead and just continues the trend, no matter how shocking it may be and how much it will cost to establish this new department of the airport. It'll be interesting to see if a private corporation can sue its own government for trademark infringement. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2JET. Okay, on to the next. It is not as though the military needs to have space cordoned off into its own department before it can bankroll exorbitant funds into a space-based military project. New details have emerged about the Pentagon's ambitious plan to build 7 different defense constellations, the first of which will include hundreds of surveillance satellites that are expected to attain full global coverage in just 6 years, known as the National Defense Space Architecture. It's the first major initiative from the newly hatched Space Development Agency, a part of the Department of Defense. Once it's built, the National Defense Space Architecture will consist of 7 constellations or layers in the parlance of the United States military. Each layer will perform a different function, such as detecting incoming missiles, alerting ground forces of potential threats, keeping tabs on potential hostile weapon systems, augmenting navigational capabilities, among other important defense roles. Launched in March 2019, the Space Development Agency is responsible for unifying and integrating the Department of Defense's space development efforts, monitoring the department's threat-driven future space architecture, and accelerating the fielding of new military space capabilities necessary to ensure the United States' technological and military advantage in space, according to a press release from the Department of Defense. The agency is on track to become part of the previously mentioned U.S. Space Force in 2022. Let me drop for a sec. Speaking at a Pentagon briefing the other day, Derek Turnier, who was appointed director of the Space Development Agency in October 2019, said that the first of these layers, the transport layer, will consist of several dozen satellites by the end of 2022, reported Space News. Once at this early threshold, the system will show that we can operate a proliferated installation and that the constellation can talk to weapon systems, said Turnier. So, in 2 years, the transport layer should be capable of pinpointing targets on the ground or the sea and tracking advanced missiles. Eventually, this initial constellation will consist of hundreds of satellites, and the entire National Defense Space Architecture System will involve thousands of satellites, according to Space News. That's a lot, but it's a far cry from Elon Musk's SpaceX Starlink mega constellations, which could reach upwards of 45,000 satellites. Still, low Earth orbit is quickly becoming a very cluttered space. The Pentagon is planning to launch dozens of satellites in 2-year increments, with the transport layer achieving regional coverage in 2024 and full global coverage in 2026, according to Turnier. The plant will require the construction of 1 new satellite each week, reports Defense One. Turnier said that each satellite will be relatively small, weighing a few hundred kilograms, costing about $10 million each, and having a life expectancy of around 5 years, as reported by Defense One. These specifications point to the goal of a rapid, steady, and ongoing satellite deployment. Ideally, Turnier wants to commission new satellites and place them in orbit within an 18 to 24 month time span. To that end, the Space Development Agency issued a broad agency announcement yesterday, in which the agency is asking for new ideas to assist with these rapid and affordable satellite implementations. Let me drop for a second. Ultimately, the 7 pending National Defense Space Architecture constellations are meant to enhance the U.S. military's ability to detect and knock out airborne threats, such as surface-to-air and hypersonic missiles. The system will coordinate with ground-based systems, which would in turn deploy the required countermeasures in its broad agency announcement. The Department of Defense described the 7 defense layers as follows. A transport layer to provide military data and connectivity at a global scale and to a full range of warfighter platforms. Battle management layer to provide mission command and control and data dissemination. Tracking layer to provide global scale warning, tracking, and targeting of advanced missile threats, including hypersonic missile systems. Custody layer to provide constant awareness of enemy surface missile launchers and support targeting for advanced missiles. Navigation layer to provide an alternative to GPS. Deterrence layer to deter hostile action in deep space, namely beyond geosynchronous Earth orbit and to the lunar distances. And support layer to enable effective integration between ground and space assets. The Pentagon will be looking to commercial partners to help develop these technologies. To that end, the Space Development Agency will be soliciting bids for the first batch of satellites in late spring of 2020 and awarding contracts in this summer. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. Well, last month, Paul spoke about possible problems future astronauts might have dealing with moon dust on department's biohazard. One department's biohazard is another department's possible fuel source. If humans were going to have a long-term presence on the moon, it's thought they're going to need breathable air and rocket fuel, and the European Space Agency might have a way to create both using the moon itself. The agency is running a prototype plant that would convert moon dust, currently just a simulation of it, of course, into oxygen that could be used for air and fuel. The technique unlocks the high amounts of oxygen in regoliths using molten salt electrolysis that superheats the dust and migrates the oxygen along the salt until it's collected at the anode. The basic process has already been used for metal and alloy production, but the European Space Agency tweaked it to ensure oxygen was available to measure. As that suggests, the process could have an upshot for moon explorers by producing useful alloys to construct habitats or repair vehicles. There's a lot of work needed before the plants like this can go to the moon. It needs to store oxygen instead of simply venting the gas. Likewise, scientists would need to determine what alloys would be most useful byproducts. A moon-worthy test plant should be ready by the mid-2020s, though, so it may be just a matter of time before explorers are producing air far from Earth. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I think they're going to need a lot of power. That will be the main problem. They're going to need some kind of nuclear power that's similar to what NASA's working on. NASA's working on systems where you could get 10K out of their fission units that they want to send up. Maybe they could team up with them. You know, that's what they're going to need. If they're going to try to do it with solar power or fuel cells, I think they're going to be in trouble. It sounds like you're going to need a lot of power to do that type of work, trying to get the oxygen out of regular dust. Back to you.
I would agree with you, Paul. There's a problem whenever any story comes up where they're synthesizing fuel is you got to remember the old line that energy cannot be created nor destroyed. It can be moved and it can be converted from one form to another. So we're just playing a shell game here. It's not the regoliths giving you the energy. You're supplying the energy up front. The regoliths are just the storage capacity with it. When you're ripping the oxygen off of metals and such, there's a very strong bond between them, and you need to. You need to have a supply of energy in order to force the equilibrium in the wrong direction. So it falls into kind of a semantical trap. Water can be electrolyzed into hydrogen and oxygen, and then you could use hydrogen and oxygen as a very efficient fuel. But that doesn't mean that water is your fuel. Whatever it is that caused the electrolysis was your fuel. I wish them well with this, but yeah, I would love to know what they possibly going to use as a power source. They'll probably tell you fusion, because it's always going to be 10 years in our future anyway.
Yeah, they could get those 10 kilowatt units that NASA's developing. They have a lot of success. They run tests with these things. They're just going to have to get it past the, fear of launching these things to space. You know, when they launched RTGs, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators years ago on spacecraft like Cassini, you know, they were protesting things. So, you know, I guess they're going to have the same type of thing. If they can get over that, then they'll be able to send these things to the moon and then use them to power things. Can't bring all that oxygen that they're going to need for refueling and breathing with them. So you're going to need to get it from the moon, and either from the regolith or from the water. I think it would be easier to get it the ice. They know the ice is there. Separate that instead of trying to get it out of the out of rock, essentially.
Well, you know, it's kind of six to one, half a dozen of the other. It would probably be technologically much easier to electrolyze water. The only problem is I don't know how readily available the water sources would be on any given landing, whereas regoliths are all around you, so I can sort of understand some guy saying, well, you know, if we're stuck and all we have is moon dust, we certainly have a lot of it. But yeah, ultimately, power is the missing equation. We need a high-density power source. Fusion would be a lovely one if it was technologically possible, which it isn't yet. So we'll probably end up with fission. It'll probably be a big political mess, and there will be people picketing no matter what you do. But I can't see, you know, there's not enough solar panels to shove across the moon to power stuff like this. So, yeah, I think they're going to have to deal with some form of fission and talk the population into accepting that idea.
Yeah, good point. The rest of the moon isn't going to be that easy to look for ice. What I'm talking about is everybody plans on going to the South Pole, and they know, like, you know, craters like Shackleton Crater and all of these craters on the South Pole have hidden ice that have, you know, it's buried there for billions of years, and they'll be able to utilize that. But yeah, good point. You know, you go up to the northern latitudes or even the equatorial areas, and you're going to have to get get the oxygen out of the dust. Now, what would be cheaper? You know, manufacturing it on the South Pole and somehow transporting it all around the moon, or, you know, setting up a base here and there throughout the moon. I guess setting up a base throughout the moon would be the way to go. So, I don't know, European Space Agency better get going then. They plan on putting people there by 2024. I think they're a long way off for doing something like this. Back to you, Roy.
I tend to think that everyone in this business is kind of really, really, really optimistic. And I sort of understand that if you were a pessimist, you'd go in investment banking. You certainly wouldn't go into that type of a business. So I can sort of understand it. So if you want someone to be overly enthusiastic and overly optimistic, these are the guys you're going to find who are going to be like that. So I don't discount the reasons why they feel that way. I hope they're right and I'm terribly wrong. But you can never predict discovery of technologies. You know, some guy at a lab in some place in India or Japan might have found something really nifty it's going to revolutionize the batteries or power storage or propulsion or God knows what else. So you never know. These things do happen. They just don't happen on the clock. So we'll just have to see how all these great ideas go. I would be completely amazed beyond belief if any of these predictions were at all accurate. But again, I can sort of understand why they want to be terribly optimistic. It helps them get up and work another day on this project.
I'm all for it. Yeah, I mean, we do have the MOXIE unit going to Mars this year. That will be launched on the next rover. So, I mean, that's going to be a proof of concept system that's actually on the rover. They're going to take that carbon dioxide air, which might be easier than taking it out of the ground, and develop, you know, creating oxygen out of that system and storing it in a container. They want to see if they could do that. If it works out, then in the future they'll send massive robots, you know, I mean, a couple of thousand pound units landed on Mars just to do one thing, create oxygen. That's what you would need. But right now is the test. They want to be able to see if they can get like a liter of oxygen. So, I mean, that's going this year. Back to you, Roy.
I wish them well. I think one of the possible avenues is terraforming mechanical objects. I think that we're going to have a much bigger robotic presence on other heavenly bodies than we're going to have guys who can, you know, shove a flag into the ground and do a little dance. So, you know, I wish all these agencies the best of luck, and I hope everything works out for everyone, but I don't know, manned missions, I'm not quite sure if this is going to be the century for them. Anyway, I have one last story before I shut down for the night that's very appropriate for the subject that we were talking. Before sending its first crewed mission in late 2021, India will launch a humanoid robot called Viomitra into space, reports the Tribune. It will take flight later this year and in 2021. According to the publication, the robot's name is a combination of the Sanskrit words for space and friend, and the India Space Research Organization modeled it after a human woman, though it doesn't feature any actual legs. The robot can operate switch panels, talk to astronauts, and monitor a spacecraft's environment and life support systems. Its primary purpose, however, is to allow Space Research Organization to test how spaceflight affects the human body before the agency sends astronauts up to one of its Ghanaian craft. It will be simulating exactly human functions there in space. It will check whether the systems are right. This will be very useful to simulate as if a human is flying. Space Research Organization Chairman Kay Sivan told reporters at the media event where the agency showed off the robot. Although Viomitra's appearance is sure to inspire headlines about its perceived gender, the fact of the matter is that sending robots into space is nothing new. Just last year, one of NASA's adorable Astrobee robots flew on its own aboard the International Space Station. When it comes to challenges of spaceflight, robots, whatever their shape, are better equipped to handle the stresses associated with leaving the Earth's atmosphere than human bodies are. Personally, I think we're getting a glimpse at what the future of, quote, manned, end quote, spacecraft will be, at least for the rest of this century. But let me drop for any questions or comments. Once again, this is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
See, they're getting there slowly but surely. You know, China's already got people in space. They, you know, Russia, U.S., now India. And they plan on doing that, I I think you said the end of the year. I know they plan on a, originally they were planning on a three-person crew. I don't know if they're going to do that or a two-person crew the first time they launch. But they're going nowhere. You know, they're going to go into orbit, and then they're going to come back. They don't have a space station to visit. They're not signed up without a space station. I don't know. Maybe they'll make a deal with China. When China has a space station, maybe they can dock to them. But, yeah, they definitely have plans, and they have long-term plans of eventually going to the moon. But, they, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how this... they've already launched one crew vehicle a few years ago with nobody in it. It didn't go into orbit. It just went straight out on a suborbital flight. They wanted to test the heat shield, and that worked, and that came back. So I guess they're doing this now with the robot.
That's time complete.
Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, it's nice to know that more people, we've talked about this before, the more the merrier. I'm not worried that that Indy is going to outclass us in some way. I think it's great that more countries invest in exploration. The story is that anywhere from this year to next year, they'll be launching the robot as a trial case. When they're going to replace the robot with actual live astronauts, that's sometime in the future of their scheduling. So the more the merrier, I think. It's not as glamorous, but I think robots are probably a reasonable compromise for machines that are somewhat similar to robots, terraforming robots, lab testing robots, all kinds of interesting robots. If it malfunctions and the battery blows up, you said for a minute or two about how much money you wasted, but otherwise no one's life is lost. But we'll see what the future brings. It's going to be exciting, whatever it is. So it is now 11 o'clock, and as always, I'll repeat myself that if you have any mailbag questions that you would like to ask Dick but you can't get on the TechNet yourself, or if you have any subjects that you would like Paul to address or articles you'd like him to see and such, or if you would like to ask a topic of me or a subject you'd like me to cover or a puzzle that you found that I might be able to use, the email address, as always, is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. All the stories will have links as soon as I can put them up in about 10, 15, 20 minutes. You go to roy.ac2gs.com, and that's my link page. And if anyone needs an audio stream, I usually feed my audio stream onto the internet. You just point your browser at technet.ac2gs.com and you'll hear what the audio sounds like from my place. So as always, I want to thank everyone who participated. I am happy to be back. I look forward to next week when we'll run through some more stories, hopefully happier stories than sadder stories. And with that, let me turn it over to Paul for the space report.
Very good, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N. And this is Paul for the space portion of the TechNet. Space Net report is done. We're usually the third group out. Dick starts off with the tech part of the net, and then Roy continues with the science talk, and then now we do the SpaceNet report. And I just wanted to actually start with something that you told me about. Somebody was asking a question at Ham Radio University that you were at, Roy, so I should do a fill on that because I know I'm going to forget, and hopefully whoever it is a listener to the net. I assume they are. Back to you, Roy, for a comment, and then I'll try to answer this question.
Yeah, sure, Paul. He was a gentleman. He attended. I had the privilege to do a talk on test equipment with Andy, WA2CDL, and it went very nicely. We could have used a much bigger room. I guess it's a good thing that we had to turn people away, although I felt terrible about it. Towards the end, we were packing things up, and the gentleman asked me the question of why the guy who was supposed